Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Friday, the 15th of December. EU leaders agree to open accession talks with Ukraine.
We are on their side, and this decision made by the member states is extremely important for the credibility of the European Union.
But will Ukraine join anytime soon? Despite American pressure to reduce civilian casualties, the Israeli Prime Minister tells the US National Security Advisor the war against Hamas will continue until absolute victory is achieved. And the leaders of Venezuela and Guyana meet to discuss their border dispute. Also in the podcast, a British boy missing for 6 years turns up in France. And...
Reporter Barbie, you can ask me any question you want.
Well, how come you're so amazing?
No comment!
The Barbie director becomes the youngest president of the Cannes Film Jury for nearly six decades. Since the pro-EU uprising in Ukraine 10 years ago, Vladimir Putin has been working to pull the former Soviet state back into Russia's orbit and away from the West. Indeed, that was arguably the main driver of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But while the fighting remains mired in stalemate, Ukraine on Thursday scored a big diplomatic victory as the EU unexpectedly agreed to open membership talks. Hungary had threatened to veto the move, but in the end, its populist right-wing Prime Minister Viktor Orban in effect abstained by reportedly leaving the room for the vote. Charles Michel, President of the European Council, said it was a historic moment for the bloc.
This is extremely important. We want to support Ukraine. It's a very powerful signal. It's a very powerful decision today and tonight. I think to the people of Ukraine, we are on their side, and this decision made by the member states is extremely important for the credibility of the European Union.
Ivana Klimpush-Tsintsadze, who is chair of Ukraine's Parliamentary Committee on EU Integration, said the news will be welcomed by many Ukrainians.
I think the whole Ukrainian nation is celebrating today because it's a breakthrough and the real ray of light at the end of this battle that we are fighting every single day. It's a slam in the face for President Putin. And finally, this should actually be a very clear signal to him that his era of upper hand should be getting to an end.
Well, I heard more from our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, in Brussels.
In recent months, Ukraine hasn't had huge amounts to crow about in terms of battlefield successes. So it's very important that it can show that the political processes of moving away from Russia towards a European environment in terms of the value systems that it aspires to is very significant. The Ukrainian foreign minister earlier in the week was talking about this being the mother of all decisions. So it really matters.
But is there any realistic prospect of Ukraine joining the EU anytime soon?
These processes take years and years. You have to realise that although Ukraine has done a lot in terms of some of the reforms that have been asked of it by the EU, it has a long, long way to go. It's a huge country. It's at war. It suffers from severe corruption. So there's a lot still to be done. But at least it feels like it's on the path. And you heard in Charles Michel's clip there, the EU's credibility was on the line on this sort of decision. The interesting thing, of course, is what Viktor Orban did. And it's hard to read everything. We've heard reports that he didn't abstain in the decision. He actually left the room. And one official suggested that this was in order then to say he didn't want any part of the decision. He's actually called it a bad decision. So perhaps this was about posturing for a domestic audience.
Briefly, was there any news on the aid package that Ukraine is hoping to get from the EU?
This is the other big decision that Ukraine's waiting for, whether the EU will approve 50 billion euros, that's $54 billion of aid. It's a four-year package designed to give Ukraine some financial stability at a time when that really matters for a country at war. There's been long and torturous negotiations about this and how it may occur. The signs from some diplomats seem to be that there is something in the offing. We're not quite sure what and how it will be delivered.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, in Brussels. The EU also opened accession talks with Moldova and granted candidate status to Georgia. According to a recently declassified intelligence report, the US believes Russia has suffered 315,000 troops killed or injured since it invaded Ukraine, equivalent to nearly 90% of its original force. And yet Vladimir Putin told his end-of-year news conference the war was going well and Russian troops were improving their positions along the front line. Our Moscow correspondent Steve Rosenberg was at the event, the first in 2 years.
There haven't been many, in fact, any opportunities for Western media to get anywhere near Vladimir Putin since his full-scale invasion of Ukraine. At least today, we were in the same room. To a fanfare, President Putin made his entrance at the start of his end-of-year TV extravaganza, half press conference, half phone-in. In the hall, hundreds of Russian journalists, but some foreign correspondents too, invited by the Kremlin. For the next 4 hours, the Russian president took questions from the media and from the Russian public. On the war in Ukraine, he's sounding increasingly confident.
There will be peace when we achieve our goals. They haven't changed. Practically along the entire line of contact, our armed forces are, to put it modestly, improving their position. They are in an active stage of operation.
The whole event was highly choreographed to present the Kremlin leader in a positive light. One pensioner who'd called to complain about egg prices had only good things to say about Putin. "You're my favourite president," she beamed. Some of the messages texted in by the public, which I spotted popping up on a screen in the studio, were critical. One declared that Putin had been in the job too long. Another read, "When will power change in Russia?" But these were not mentioned on air. And my question to Vladimir Putin? Sadly, I wasn't given an opportunity to ask it. Pity that, because after nearly 2 years of war, I have so many questions for Russia's president.
Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg. The war in Gaza has already lasted more than 9 weeks, but Israel says it will take a long time, more than several months, to wipe out Hamas and prevent any repeat of the massacre of the 7th of October. That time frame will inevitably put many more Palestinians at risk of death or injury. Indeed, one little-noticed report by UK-based charity Air Wars found that at the end of October, Israeli airstrikes killed at least 126 civilians while targeting a Hamas commander. The US has been pushing Israel to reduce civilian casualties and in particular be more accurate with its air attacks. Asked whether he wanted Israel to scale back its assault on Hamas, President Biden told reporters he wanted to see more done to protect civilians.
"I want them to be focused on how to save civilian lives, not stop going after Hamas, but be more careful."
The US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan had travelled to Israel to underline that message. But after meeting the Israeli Prime Minister on Thursday, he didn't set out a timetable for any reduction in the fighting.
"Israel is going to continue to conduct its military efforts to get after Hamas for some time. Because, for example, they're going to continue to hunt the top leaders of Hamas, Sinwar and Deif and Issa. And we don't know exactly how long that will take. So the issue really is, when does Israel shift from the high-intensity military operations that are underway today to a different phase of this conflict, one that's more precise, more targeted, more driven towards things like those high-value individuals?"
Jake Sullivan. So what exactly does that mean about transitioning? I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Hugo Bachega.
I think the White House has been very clear here that they want the war to be over as soon as possible. And the Israelis are saying, well, look, we need more time because of all the reasons Jake Sullivan mentioned, that they haven't yet captured leaders of Hamas, including the top Hamas leader in Gaza. And also the Israelis are saying that they want to destroy Hamas, but also to release all the hostages who remain in captivity. But at the same time, I think the message has been very clear. There's growing discontent in Washington over what's happening in Gaza, and there's growing international pressure for a ceasefire because of mounting civilian casualties in Gaza, because of the humanitarian situation that has been described as catastrophic by the UN. The Israelis so far have been against a ceasefire, saying that this would only benefit Hamas. So far, the US has been supporting this view, but I think you can see the pressure is building on Israel, even from the US, which is the country's main ally.
Yeah, the pressure's building, but even so, we still hear like the defense minister saying it could last many months, and the Israeli prime minister saying we will go on until Hamas is defeated.
Exactly. And here in Israel, the conversations that are happening suggest that the Israelis think that this phase of the war, these, you know, high intensity operations are going to last until the beginning of February. And I think for the White House, they want to talk about weeks and not months in this war. And again, as this war continues, more Palestinians are going to die, more scenes of widespread destruction are going to emerge. And the pressure is going to continue on the Israelis. And at some point, a ceasefire will have to happen.
Hugo Bachega in Jerusalem. There hasn't been a major war between South American countries for many years. But could that now be at risk after a controversial referendum by Venezuela, which backed its claim to large swathes of neighbouring Guyana, in particular the oil-rich region of Essequibo? The Guyanese president, Irfan Ali, denounced the claim as outrageous. Since the referendum, tensions between the two countries have been high. These residents in Essequibo told the BBC how they felt.
Very scared about what could happen, because we already know what happened in Venezuela with Maduro. He already destroyed Venezuela. He will destroy this place, actually.
I have it in my mind that Venezuela will not make a move towards Guyana, at least not by force. We are a zone of peace, as they say, and hopefully today we get something favorable out of their discussions.
Residents of Essequibo in Guyana. In an attempt to defuse the increasingly tense situation, the two leaders held face-to-face talks in St. Vincent and the Grenadines. This is what the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro had to say on his way in.
I come on behalf of the people of Venezuela with words of dialogue, with words of peace. And I come to seek effective solutions through the only way possible, which is dialogue and negotiation.
Nicolas Maduro. Ahead of the talks, Tim Frank spoke to the Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines and the man who brokered the meeting, Ralph Gonsalves.
It is important that certain basic principles are reaffirmed. And there's a recommitment to the Caribbean and Latin America as a zone of peace, that we pursue matters within the framework of international law, that there be no threats of force or use of force. And then the question of modalities can be established in order to look at certain issues consequential to the dispute, the border controversy. So it's better that persons be talking rather than quarreling or fighting. I'm not offering any public advice. I'm a facilitator and interlocutor. There is a big divide, but there are other things for persons to talk about, for the leaders to discuss, and to reduce tensions, to de-escalate the conflict. We don't want a Gaza in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Indeed. I spoke to the president of Guyana when Venezuela was holding its referendum. I mean, and he was saying that it's extremely worried that this could be whipped up into a conflict. But essentially, this is internationally recognized as Guyanese land.
Let us look at scenarios which are worse than where we are in, my brother. The companies in Guyana exploring for oil, largely American. If you have anything adverse to American lives or property, you can see where that would lead. Guyana is not a match militarily for Venezuela, and it is building alliances with other hemispheric entities. And if you were to have a conflict, use of force, you don't need any imagination to see the kind of conflagration you're going to have and the consequences going to be horrendous for everybody. And historically, it is always better to be talking. President Lula, I got a call late last night from him, wishing us all the well here in the talks. I'm facilitating as President Pro Tempore of the Community of States of Latin America and the Caribbean, CELAC, to which both Guyana and Venezuela belong, and also with the Caribbean community, to which Guyana belongs, so that we are all seeking to use diplomacy to diffuse a situation which could easily get out of hand and lead to destabilization and bloodshed. And nobody wants that.
Ralph Gonsalves, Prime Minister of the Caribbean nation of St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And after the meeting, the Venezuelan and Guyanan presidents shook hands. We didn't get any details about what had gone on during the talks, but the Guyanese leader said that Guyana would continue to facilitate investments and commercial partnerships in the oil-rich region of Essequibo, despite Venezuela's renewed claims to the territory. Now, what do filmmakers Martin Scorsese, Tim Burton and Pedro Almodovar have in common? Well, they were all given the highly prized role of jury president at the Cannes Film Festival. And now Barbie director Greta Gerwig is joining their ranks. And she's the youngest person to do it in nearly 60 years. Madeline Drury has this report.
Reporter Barbie, you can ask me any question you want.
How come you're so amazing?
No comment!
With the record-breaking Barbie film under her belt, it really has been Greta Gerwig's year. Highest-grossing film directed by a woman? Check. Over $1 billion made at the box office? Check. And now she will be the first female US director to chair the prestigious Cannes Film Festival jury. Stunned, thrilled and humbled is how she's put it in a statement. It will be her job to lead a panel of filmmakers in deciding the winners of the top prizes next year at one of the world's most prestigious film festivals. It's a big deal for Gerwig, recognition that she has well and truly made it after years as a critically acclaimed actor, writer and director.
Women, they have minds and they have souls as well as just hearts.
Her 2019 adaptation of Little Women was nominated for 6 Oscars, likely one of the reasons that festival organisers called her an obvious choice to lead the jury. But their claim that Gerwig embodies the renewal of world cinema has ruffled some film buff feathers online. Is corporate Hollywood slop the pinnacle of world cinema now? One person wrote on X. It's wrong to choose a director who has made headlines to satisfy popular culture, said another. As Barbie leads the Golden Globes nominations with 9 nods, it could be Gerwig who has the last laugh.
Madeline Drury. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
This year I'm nominated for an album by Luis Figueroa. The category is Best Salsa Album.
The acclaimed Zimbabwean producer who's been nominated for a Grammy. Returning to the Middle East now, and the conflict between Hamas and Israel has resulted in 20,000 deaths so far, 1,200 killed in the Hamas massacre in southern Israel, and nearly 19,000 Palestinians in the Israeli operation in Gaza. The situation there is getting worse with bad weather and horrendous sanitary conditions. At a news conference in Geneva, the head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Philippe Lazzarini, said civilians in Gaza felt betrayed by the rest of the world and called for renewed efforts to end the war.
In suffering, there is absolutely no competition. And I believe ultimately in this war, there will be no winner. The longer this war goes on, the larger the loss, the deeper the grief. So I think, like many of my colleagues, that there is absolutely no alternative to a proper, genuine political process to end once for all the longest-lasting, unresolved conflict. 75 years, it is time that this becomes a proper priority.
Our international editor Jeremy Bowen has been in Tel Aviv and the occupied West Bank, reflecting on how, when and whether a peaceful solution might ever be found.
In a video, a woman is sitting next to her dead husband. "We promised we would die together," she says, and grips his hand hard, as if the power of her grief will bring him back. "Mohammed," she says, "my love, for God's sake, get up." Noor and Aboud, their children, were killed with their father when Israel bombed the house where the family were sheltering in Rafah. War is a cruel furnace, but its heat can produce changes that seemed impossible. Old enemies can decide that only peace can protect them from the pain of war. Could it happen here? In the days after the Hamas attacks of the 7th of October, I went to Kibbutz Be'eri, which backs onto the border wire. It was tense, and the bodies of dead Israelis were still being recovered. I was trying to find out what had happened to Vivian Silva, one of Israel's best-known campaigners for peace with the Palestinians.
Totally burnt out. I mean, there's nothing.
Vivian's son, Jonathan Zeigen, had hoped that she might still be alive.
So you were there, I was there afterwards, and her bones were in the safe room all the while.
After his mother was killed, Jonathan gave up his career as a social worker to become a full-time peace campaigner.
She would have been heartbroken. It feels like this war is a cause in itself. And we can choose to act differently. When we act differently, we get different results.
You are still a believer in peace, even though these people came over into your country and killed your mother.
I believe that it can lead to a better future now, because beforehand, peace as an idea was obsolete. You couldn't even say the word. And now people are talking about it.
The Americans have said when this ends, there needs to be a negotiation leading to a two-state solution. Credible anymore?
I think we should say out loud what we want to happen. Let's talk about what it looks like. And let's talk about what we are willing to give or to concede in order for that to happen.
Handcuffed me, blindfolded me, gagged me, took me to the military base.
Issa Amro, a Palestinian activist from Hebron, will not forget what Israeli security forces did to him on the 7th of October. Issa is well known in Hebron, which has been a flashpoint on the West Bank for decades. He's considered a troublemaker by Israeli soldiers who are enforcing a curfew on Palestinians who live near the Jewish settlement in the heart of the city. As we're talking, there's an interruption. So the army's coming. What do you think they want?
Intimidation.
Good morning.
A little bit, Eita.
Why must we stop filming? We have accreditation.
No, we ask for two things. Don't film us. Second thing, don't film...
There's checkpoint.
We are allowed to film.
No, no,
right?
There is law.
I am the law at the moment.
No, no, you are not the law.
It's not legal what you do. I know my rights.
You are a very prominent activist.
Yeah,
you don't hesitate to answer them back.
Yes, it's my freedom to fight. I'm using non-violence resistance since 20 years.
One of the Israeli soldiers carrying an assault rifle was listening closely to my conversation with Issa. His eyes moved back and forth between us. He was wearing a black ski mask. Finally, he butted in.
Yeah, I have Arab work for me. I know them. I live with them. I want peace. They don't want peace. They hit their women. They are violent.
It's kind of racism. He has workers. He wants to see the Palestinians only as workers. He doesn't want to see me as equal human being, deserve the same rights as him. And I know many Israelis disagree with him. I used to meet thousands of Israelis per year, and we talk about peace. But unfortunately, the right wing in Israel and the mainstream move to the right, even attack Israeli seculars.
Do you think the shock of the war in Gaza will change things?
It's two opportunities. It's either we choose to make it deeper and worse, or we make it as an opportunity to solve the conflict. Because their security solution failed. Only peace is the solution.
Issa Amro ending that report by our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. A British boy said to have been abducted in Spain at the age of 11 has turned up 6 years later in France. Alex Batty, now 17, was taken to a police station by a concerned driver who spotted him walking in the foothills of the Pyrenees. Our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield, took me through the story.
He was on holiday in the south of Spain with his mother and grandfather. It needs to be said from the outset there's something problematic in that because his mother was not his legal guardian. There'd been a family rift and his legal guardian was his grandmother. He was on holiday with the mother and the grandfather and from the south of Spain they disappeared. And the belief was, and the accusation certainly made by the guardian, the grandmother back in England, was that the mother had taken him off probably to some kind of cult or commune in Morocco where it was known she'd been before. That was the end of it. They were never seen again after that, and it was assumed that they were hiding out in Morocco or somewhere else. There were police investigations, but they never went anywhere until today, or yesterday, when this young man, now age 17, suddenly walked back into the world in this unlikely setting of southern France, the foothills of the Pyrenees, south of Toulouse, looking perfectly happy with a backpack and a skateboard and a headlamp. He was picked up by this delivery driver and taken to a police station where he said, I am Alex Batty, and I'd like to go home to England now.
And do we know, did he have to escape from this commune? How did he just suddenly turn up there?
My impression is that there's no duress involved, but he was a young boy when he went, and his mother would have taken him there, and his grandfather, presumably. But the years have passed, and he's grown to young manhood and has decided that it's not for him. So I don't think there does not seem to be any kind of escape plan involved or any abuse of him. He simply decided that enough was enough. He did not find this life particularly congenial, and he wanted to get back to the real world.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Staying in France, and one of the nation's most famous music stars.
Je vis au cœur de la planète, j'ai dans la tête un carnaval de confetti, j'en amène jusque dans mon lit.
Well, that upbeat tune was the breakout hit for Serge Gainsbourg back in 1958. A funny, if also dark, song about a ticket puncher on the Paris metro. Gainsbourg, who died in 1991, has been credited with transforming French music. And a new metro station is due to be named after him when it opens next year. But thousands of people have signed a petition objecting, on the grounds that Gainsbourg, while talented, was deeply unsavoury. Among the co-authors of the petition is Ludine, and we've agreed not to reveal her surname because the issue has become so polarised.
Gainsbourg was known in France for his provocative attitudes. That's what it was called at the time. But we know now that Jane Birkin, his wife of the time, denounced marital violence and beating on his part in her diaries. He has also always cultivated the fantasy of incest in his songs, such as La Poupée qui fait, promoted it. He says he wants to rape a little doll that calls him daddy, and even if it wasn't his intentions, when you sing a song like that, in the culture, it means something. In the society, you know, people hear it. And I am not saying that Serge Gainsbourg committed incest on singing that. He promoted it in his heart. I don't really think that other metro stations should be renamed. I mean, it's not my fight right now. It's not our fight. But what really shocks me and shocks us is that it's Serge Gainsbourg's name is being chosen now, like in 2023, you know, after Me Too and the release of the stories we know about. I don't want to like erase history and change the whole metro plan. That's not my point at all. People are very emotionally linked to him, and it's really a problem in France, like separating the man from the artist. A lot of us don't agree anymore, but unfortunately, the most vocal people tend to be the one who doesn't agree.
Ludine, one of the co-authors of a petition to stop a Paris metro station being named after Serge Gainsbourg. Next to a breakthrough in English football, and Rebecca Welch is to become the first woman to referee a Premier League match. She'll take charge of the Fulham-Burnley clash on the 23rd of December. A few days later, Sam Allison will be the league's first black referee for 15 years. Simon Stone has the details.
Rebecca Welch is an experienced referee. The atmosphere of a Premier League stadium will be familiar to her as she walks out to the centre circle at Craven Cottage on the Saturday before Christmas. She was the fourth official at a top-flight game last month and was the first woman to take charge of an English Football League match. She was also at the Women's World Cup this summer. English football's head of refereeing, Howard Webb, told me she has the experience of big games and was the leading light in a strong field of female officials.
Really confident that she'll deliver a game in the Premier League and obviously be a really good role model for women and girls who maybe might think refereeing's for them as well when previously they didn't. It's about quality people having an opportunity regardless of your background.
Howard Webb had another announcement. Sam Allison will be in charge of Sheffield United against Luton on Boxing Day, the first black referee of a Premier League match since Uriah Rennie retired from officiating the top divisions in 2009.
Simon Stone. Dr. Chai is a Zimbabwean music producer based in Los Angeles. He was recently nominated for a Grammy in the Latin category. He's also doing well as a recording artist in his own right. Speaking to DJ Edu on the World Service's This Is Africa, he explained how his success really started when the Jamaican superstar Sean Paul decided to record one of his songs.
Yeah, it's Dr. Chai.
Okay. Oh, if you love me, take this cup away from me. Oh, all of this is so you
I've been here for 6 years now. And at the time, the dream was to move to LA to become a music producer and to write songs and produce for all these artists. And so when I graduated, I said, Mama, Daddy, my friend said I could go to LA and try this out. You know, African parents, there's always a deal. there's always a hustle. And so for me, my deal was, you know, because I always made beats when I was in school. And so my parents looked at me and they said, okay, look, we know you love the music thing. For the first 3 months of you going out to LA, we'll support you. And if it works out, after 3 months, you stay. If it doesn't work out, you come home and you do your 9-to-5 and you go do your life in advertising. And so I think it was the last 2 weeks of that 3 months when I got the call that Sean Paul would be recording the song. So a very, very special time and a deal I'll never forget. Baby girl, you give me 10 ton of fatness, give me some of that. Thinks with the badness, look how she at. She apply goddess, but I'm not just that. It's a good piece of mental sand that they cap.
You are now a Grammy-nominated producer via the Latin route. How does that feel?
Feels phenomenal. You know, I think I need to start learning Spanish one of these days.
Por favor, por favor.
Por favor. So I've been nominated for the Latin Grammys twice now. The first time was a song called Hey Ma by Pitbull, J Balvin, and Camila Cabello. This year I'm nominated for an album by Luis Figueroa. The category is Best Salsa Album. What I love about Latin Americans is that, you know, they really, really are connected even with their African roots. And so there's a lot of similarities between Africans and Latin Americans in a way where even sometimes you won't be speaking the same language, but you're like, ha, I feel like I understand what this guy is saying.
The Grammy-nominated Dr. Chai talking to DJ Edu. And you can hear the full interview by going to bbcworldservice.com/thisisafrica. And that's all from us for now. But the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Lee Wilson and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.